This podcast of Left, Right, and Center is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support this free service by September 5th and you could win a Mini Cooper S convertible. Go to KCRW.com for details.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Is this a war on terror or not? What's so dumb about intelligent design? Plus, Snuppy the Clone Dog and Cool Hand Bob Novak. Hello again and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the screaming talking heads that dominate political debate. I'm Matt Miller, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and columnist for Fortune magazine, holding down the center here on Left, Right, and Center. Joining me on the left side of the political spectrum here in Santa Monica is Robert Scheer, syndicated columnist based at the Los Angeles Times. On the right in Washington, as always, is Tony Blankley, editorial page editor and columnist for the Washington Times. Arianna Huffington is off vacationing, I think, today. A big week. Let's start with the war rebranding. Obviously, a serious topic, but one that's also kicking up lots of commentary and controversy. This is in the context of what seemed to be an effort over the recent weeks, and there were even little intimations of it in Donald Rumsfeld and others' speeches and language over previous months, an effort to seem to abandon the phrase war on terror to describe what we are in the midst of, and a preference for phrases like the global struggle against extremism or against Islamic extremism. President Bush himself weighed in this week, publicly overruling, at least in the words of the New York Times, some of his top advisors on Wednesday in a debate about what to call the conflict with Islamic extremists, saying, make no mistake about it, we are at war. And he used the phrase war dozens of times in the speech. Tony Blankley, you're a student of semantics as well as war. What are we in? What do you make of this debate, I guess? Is it a debate within the administration? Is it a rebranding? And what's the significance of it all, given where things stand?
I think words do matter. And the criticism from the pro-war on terror right, of which I have a card that I carry with me, from the beginning has been that the war on terror is not a complete description of the danger and the enemy. The enemy is an Islamist insurgency, and it should be so named. Terror is merely a device, a strategy, a tactic, and is insufficiently precise. We've heard for months, I mentioned in a column several months ago, that the administration was trying to figure out how to rephrase it. What's happened is, as they've come up with this phrase, the struggle against extremism, something like that, people have chosen to interpret that, I think, as therefore it's no longer a war. I viewed it as adding to the scope of our concern, but it was being characterized as subtracting, particularly with the false rumors that we're going to remove troops from Iraq. People tied it all together and said, we're dropping the military component of the war on terror. And so I think the president went out and said, five times in 3 minutes, war on terror, to let everybody know that he wasn't subtracting from his sense of mission. That's the best I can make of it. But it does matter, finally, if we can name the enemy, because if you can't name the enemy, you can't discuss the enemy precisely, and therefore you may confuse the public.
Yeah, Bob, I want to get you in, but here's what my take has been on this. And I viewed it, I think, as a much more – I always viewed the original choice of the phrase war on terror, which was done within about 3 days of September 11th, as a very political decision to brand this effort as a war, in my view, improperly, because it's going to be – if it's a war, you know, it's like the Cold War. This is something that's going to be going on for 100 years. And I thought that Karl Rove or others in the White House around Bush made a very conscious decision to call it a war because it would – if those were the terms of debate, then it would, I thought, put the Republican Party, who already holds an edge on national security, in a position to – win elections or have an extra, who knows, 5-8 points at the margin in elections for the indefinite future, because the war, quote, would never end. And so the idea that this was being and Tony Blair never talks about it that way, I think. He always has used fight, struggle, et cetera, et cetera. And so the idea that this was being recalibrated not surprisingly, after Bush had won re-election, I took to mean two things. One was that they thought this branding wasn't working anymore, which I took as significant in terms of just the politics of it. But second, that since they were safely over the goal line of re-election, it wasn't something that was going to work for the next five elections, but it had done its job. Bob, where are you on how this is?
Well, I'm struggling to be
polite. You're at war with yourself.
I'm struggling to be polite in my response, because the conversation you guys have been having is sort of weird. I mean, you both bought not the brand but the lie that going into Iraq, and I know you don't want to revisit it, but you bought the lie that going invading Iraq.
Well, wait, first it was called the War on Terror long before we went into Iraq. It was called the War on Terror 3 days after September 11th, or 10 days later in that speech. So that was, you know, a year and a half before Iraq. Just a point
of course,
clarification.
That was not my point. My point is this president deceived the country into saying that going to Iraq had something to do with the War on Terror. And you guys both bought that. Maybe you still both believe it. The problem they have is they're having this big battle in Iraq, and they're trying to justify it and say why we shouldn't get out. And the way they justify it is to say it's connected with a larger war on terror. Okay? So that remains the problem here. And it may be a self-fulfilling hypothesis here. It may be that if you go and invade a country in which Islam is a dominant religion, you may be able to breed terrorism as a tactic against you by people there. But we have to face up to the original idea of the war on terror, to go after Osama bin Laden, the people who attacked the World Trade Center and the Pentagon and so forth, had nothing to do with Iraq. And so we're caught now in this mess where we're creating an enemy. We created an enemy in Iraq, which we didn't have. I agree, however, with what Tony said, that terrorism is a tactic. Doesn't really define the problem. But we're using some very sloppy language here. You say it should be called a war against Islamic fanaticism. Well, what does that mean? The fact is the people who killed 40 Marines in the last couple of weeks probably weren't Islamic fanaticists. They're probably nationalist fanatics, if you like, or strong nationalists or fervid nationalists. But they probably were Ba'ath Party people. According to the military, suicide bombing actually went down in the last month. What we've seen is, in fact, people doing urban warfare against us. And yes, the loss of life is real. But as far as Islamic fanaticism, you have this bizarre situation where the true fanatics, these real strong Islamic fanatics who are allied with Iran, are the people on our side in Iraq. A U.S. reporter was killed in Basra for writing in the New York Times a truthful piece about how the troops that we're bringing in to Basra and to the army are recruited from Maqdad Sadr, who's an ally of Chalabi, who is a guy we thought was going to be the George Washington of his country. So, in fact, this branding of Islamic fanaticism doesn't work, because in Iraq we have plenty of Islamic fanaticists, Shiite fanaticists, who are on our side, and that we're fighting their civil war against the Sunnis.
Tony?
Yeah, look, I take Robert's point, but not very far. There's no doubt that that the enemy, as I see it, which is the Islamist insurgency, will find allies of convenience from time to time, as all combatants do find it, allies of convenience. And right now they may well be finding former Ba'athist secularists or nationalists to work to fight with them. The fact that we may currently be fighting with some people as well as Islamists doesn't mean that the central danger that we face comes from this negative energy coming out of Islam. That's the danger. The word war is a lousy word to use, because it doesn't look like World War II. We don't have millions of men in troops in uniforms, etc. But it evokes the level of physical danger that we face, although it is not geographically focused as wars against nations usually are. We're caught in a semantic trap that is defining to some extent what we're allowed and not allowed to do during, quote, wartime. I think wartime powers are necessary, but we don't have a natural war. So the law and language has trouble right now dealing with this new phenomena we're facing. And I think this debate will go on for quite a while, trying to figure out how do we describe something that is very dangerous but not like things we've seen before.
What do you make, Tony, of the political calculation that I was describing, though? Do you be honest? What are the, you know, in the when you and Karl Rove sit down?
Didn't you guys?
Didn't you guys? Didn't you guys use wasn't the idea of war partly to because it's so potent for just that reason? Or just
I completely agree that Rove's job is to be political and to calculate for votes. That's his job. I don't believe that the president chose the phrase war on terror in order to win elections. I do suspect that once the war on terror had been declared, that Roe figured out how can we use that, use everything we can find to maximize votes. That's what party political guys do. I wouldn't connect the two, though. I believe that Bush sincerely believes this is a war on terror that he intends to fight as long as he's president, and that's separate from Roe's job of trying to get the president reelected.
But that's the other thing then that falls down on that is if the president thinks it's a war, you don't cut taxes for wealthy people during a time of war. You don't place the full burden of a, quote, war on a sliver of the population, 150,000 troops who are there,
well, look,
their families and neighbors and those. I mean, that's not war.
You do a lot of things. Sometimes they're smart and sometimes they're dumb. Sometimes they're noble and sometimes they're venal during war. And we can debate which of those the president has done. I've got a book coming out, which I'll be fairly critical of how much we've marshaled resources or failed to marshal resources to fight this.
When is it coming out, by the way? He said, inviting a promotion.
September 11th, 4 years after September 11th, 2001.
Well, I'm sure we'll hear more about it first on Left, Right, and Center. But finish your point, and then Bob.
No, that was basically my point, that I don't endorse, and I can be a strong supporter of the war on terror and generally be a supporter of the president and not agree with any number of the things he's done. And I've written a book that identifies many things that I think he's done inadequately.
Bob?
You know, if someone had gone to sleep, say, somewhere in the late 80s and woke up now, they wouldn't understand this discussion at all because you're talking about a war against Islamic extremists, okay? In the late 80s, Saddam Hussein was our ally, the U.S. ally, embraced by Donald Rumsfeld in this war against the Islamic extremists. The Islamic extremists were based in Tehran. We now have a situation where someone, Chalabi, who talked the neoconservatives and others or was used by them to justify invading Iraq, who the U.S. government has said gave secrets to Tehran, who has a summer home in Tehran, a movement, the Ayatollah Sistani, who has lived there, born there, trained there. So you have the people that we are trying to put in power in Iraq or consolidate their power are allied with the people in Tehran that we defined as Islamic fanatics. And now you want to justify continued involvement in Iraq saying we're taking on Islamic fanatics. It doesn't work. The whole analysis is illogical. Center of Islamic fanaticism right now is very much in Tehran, according to our own government. Right? And yet we're trying to put their allies who have just were over there visiting, making alliances, trade, building a pipeline, doing a common security, exchanging security. We're trying to put their cohorts in power in Iraq. And you say that's a battle in the war against Islamic extremists. It just doesn't wash.
You can have been awake since 1988 and still be confused about the present, as am I to some extent. But the fact that you have varying, switching roles of different people is not surprising. In the 30 Years' War, the sides shifted. Princes went back and forth. Iraq, obviously was our ally when fighting Khomeini. We were with the Mujahideen when fighting the Soviets. This is all prior to September 11th, obviously. And I think at this point we have to try to, if we can, purge ourselves from all the past events and try to look at the world as we find it today. And today, unfortunately, a large focus of the Islamist insurgency is on the West and on the United States particularly, and that's the danger we need to try to grapple with.
I guess the last thought, we're going to have to take a break in a second, is why do you think it's so different the way we're framing this and the way folks like Tony Blair, who obviously has put all his political and substantive and moral bona fides behind a war in Iraq? He doesn't talk about war on terror. He talks about it in a much different way.
Was he attacked by Iraqis or Pakistanis? Ethiopians. I mean, what are we talking about?
He was actually attacked by Englishmen.
But according to the English government, to the degree that they've been able to trace this to schools, religious schools, they weren't in Iraq. They weren't financed by Saddam Hussein. If these Pakistanis got any educational, they got it in
No one's saying it's all about Iraq.
Wait a minute. I'm just saying. saying. No, it's just the opposite. We have embraced Pakistan as a great center of enlightenment. These people went to Pakistan after 9/11. They got their training there, according to the British government. They attack England, and yet somehow the war in Iraq is still justified.
We're going to have to leave it there. Up ahead, the death of Darwin plus Snuppy the clone dog. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Find more Left, Right, and Center programs and podcasts at kcrw.com.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Matt Miller in the center. Robert Scheer is with me on the left. Tony Blankley is in Washington on the right. Another big dust-up in the news this week by President Bush stepping into the intelligent design versus evolution controversy. A sharp debate between scientists and religious conservatives escalated when Bush said the theory of intelligent design should be taught with evolution in the nation's public schools. I felt like both sides ought to be properly taught, Bush said. And when he was asked by a reporter whether he believed that both sides should be taught, he said yes, so people can understand what the debate is about. Tony Blankley, what do you make of it?
Well, first of all, my position has always been that there's no role for theology instruction in science classes, whether they're in public schools or private schools. And to the extent that intelligent design is theology in scientists' clothing, it should not be part of it. Intelligent design argument is actually fascinating. It's the two pieces to it. One piece is a purely scientific argument that Darwinism is an incomplete or inadequate explanation for the phenomena being analyzed. That is, to the extent that you use science to criticize Darwin, as a legitimate discussion within the class, in any science class, just as in a physics class you might assess the various theories flowing out of the Big Bang and how many parallel universes we have, etc., using physics. The second and the more controversial part asserts that you can deduce from the complexity of detail in nature an intelligent designer. This strikes me to be essentially Thomas Aquinas's fifth argument for the proof of God from Summa Theologiae, the fifth argument being argument from design. And Aquinas spent his whole brilliant life trying to prove God by reason and failed. Now they're taking that approach and trying to use probability theory, information theory, various scientific glosses to prove what I believe is unprovable absent faith, which is the existence of an intelligent designer or God. And I believe they do not win the better of that argument, and it should not be in the classroom.
Bob?
Wow. Okay. Well, there's nothing for me to say. I mean, clearly Darwin can be taught. We dodged that bullet. But did you ever think we were even defending Darwin? Somebody had told me 30, 40 years ago that at this point in the advance of civilization, we'd have to defend the idea of studying evolution. That this would be controversial. I would wonder, how did this happen? And I think it happened because of political charlatans. I really do. And I think people, and unfortunately, for Tony, many of them are your friends in the Republican Party, including the president.
I have friends in the Democratic Party.
Okay, well, there are certainly charlatans there, but not on this issue as many. The fact is, I think there's a snicker when they take this position. Now, maybe not the president. I don't know. He seems to be very faith-based and not interested in logic sometimes. But the fact is, I think it's being used, and it's used in a very cynical way, because, in fact, we're in a society that wants science, wants to be competitive in science, doesn't want to demean science for ideological or religious reasons. We've always been contemptuous of it, and we are now dilly-dallying with this in a very I shouldn't say dilly-dallying. We're playing with this in a very dangerous way because you can score political points. It's shameful.
I see. That strikes me as a little condescending, Bob. I mean, I don't doubt that this is being used for political reasons, but I come at this in a simpler way. And I've tried, you know, I read there was a long New Yorker piece a couple of months ago about intelligent design that was trying to explain in a sophisticated way, I guess, why why it didn't hold water scientifically. But to me, this always gets down to why is it wrong? I guess I come at it this way. Why is it wrong? Because it's not irreconcilable to me. If you're talking about the origins of life, which I think this is what it's about, to talk about to our children, which we would say at home anyway, and in school, that while evolution is the best understanding we have now that science has given us of how we evolved, that there are still many people who think that the original matter and life that got here was something from God. That's what I believe. Yeah. And I don't find those things irreconcilable at all. I find them totally consistent. And I always feel that there's a little smidgen of condescension in the way that you come at this, which sort of dismisses, I think, those who – I think that's the impulse they bring to this debate and find the idea that that can't be discussed with school children to be something that's in itself kind of morally offensive. I mean, there was an interesting piece, Tony, you may have seen in the Weekly Standard by – I forget, is it David Gelertner talking about the incredible ignorance of the Bible among younger people today. And I actually think that's something to be lamented. It's still a wellspring of civilization in the idea that we can't talk both about where science is and about the fact that a lot of people think that this came from God. Go ahead.
But the point is, it's not in shouldn't be in a science class. I mean, the problem is you're dealing with a phenomenon of the causeless effect. It's the same thing with the Big Bang. Physicists have explained with extraordinary precision what happens from a fraction of a moment after the Big Bang, but they cannot go back that extra bit to explain how that huge effect what the cause was. And
what should the science teacher say when the eighth grader raises his hand and says, "Well, wait a minute, how'd the stuff get there in the first place?" He should say, "Well, go ask your mother." You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, the fact is that humanity does not have an answer to that question other than through faith. And people can teach their faith in a comparative religion class. You can teach with different faiths how they come to the creation concept. But physicists, biologists are all going to be stymied, I think, inevitably, to get past the problem that you can't make the leap from an effect to a cause you can't prove.
But just in common sense, doesn't that mean a teacher can say some people – the honest answer is we don't know. Some people think there's God.
Matt, I'm really thrilled that you feel this way, but I think your attitude is extremely condescending to the whole idea of science. No one is saying you can't
have – I'm pro-science.
Yeah, yeah. The people who went after Galileo were two, you know. Let me just say –
I didn't hear that insult, so
The issue is science has been under attack by primitive theology ever since there's been science. It's a real issue, and I think it's condescending to dismiss it as an issue.
I'm saying
what we are
reconciled.
Talking about, as Tony pointed out, is what is taught in a science class, not what is discussed in a philosophy class or the history of religion. There are plenty of venues. What you're doing in a science class is, first of all, you're applying something called the scientific method. You're stating hypothesis. You're dealing with evidence, and you don't go beyond that. You don't go beyond that.
The teacher should say
there are a great deal of mystery in life, and those are discussed in other classes. They're discussed in the literature class. They're discussed in the philosophy class. But here in biology, we're trying to follow observable phenomena. We're trying to test hypotheses. We're trying to follow something called the scientific method. And there are other people undermining it. If intelligent design were a theory put forward as a hypothesis that could be tested scientifically, in which experiments could be done and so forth, everybody would be for testing. It'd be very exciting. So I think your attitude is a bit smug and, if you like, condescending.
I think it's totally common sense.
I think what is happening here is that that people have chosen, and I do think there's a real political motive here, to exploit very primitive feelings about religion. Whether it's done, by the way, in the Islamic world is not fundamentally different than what is done in the name of Christianity. They, too, attack science all the time. They, too, are against modernization for that reason. So you could be having the same discussion in a school in Pakistan or in Iraq, for that matter. And what we have to be careful about here is that we protect the scientific method. We protect – we look, cherish it. And that's what's being assaulted here. Don't trivialize it. It's being assaulted.
I'm not trivializing. You can honor the scientific method and also honor exactly what you said, the mystery in life. And the idea that you think the eighth grade bio or science teacher should say when Stevie – asks, Well, but how'd the stuff get in the Big Bang? Either ask your parents or go to your literature class. I think
they
got to move on.
We know they could very clearly say biology deals with these issues.
Got to move on. Tony, last word on this.
I was just going to say that the struggle between religious people criticizing science and scientific secularists criticizing religion is a sad and long history. They should be seen, I think, complementarily. And it's certainly true, as you said earlier, that the religion has been unfairly attacked by many secularists, and we're paying the price now, so it's difficult to get to a rational complementary view of the two phenomena.
You think that this conversation might have indicated that? Let's move on. Snuppy, the clone dog, another sort of news this week, although it happened a couple of months ago, but at least hitting the front pages this week, that Snuppy, and the New York Times was very careful to say, not Snoopy, it's Snuppy for South Korean National University puppy, was cloned. This sort of at a moment when there's both angst about us losing our edge in advanced scientific methods like this and also angst in terms of the moral issues at stake as we begin to find new ways to actually adapt ourselves. We'll never be able to do justice to this in the 90 seconds we have time for to deal with it right now. But, Tony, what'd you make of it? And briefly, where does it go?
Well, obviously, this isn't primarily about dogs. It's primarily about cloning. You're right. There's a danger that we're going to lose our scientific technological preeminence if we restrict research. On the other hand, there are terrible ethical challenges that divide the country. I think, for those who say they're only concerned about human life being protected, I think that the creation of unusual animals, the chimera in mythology, is likely to disturb people who believe that the world was created in the proper way.
Bob?
Well, I did what you insist I do, Matt. I actually went to my CD-ROM of the Old and New Testament. I searched for cloning, couldn't find it. But I'm sure it's not condoned. We're playing with God's will. If God wanted these animals to be done this way, God would have done it without the help of all of us. And so by your standard, because you seem to think there's great enlightenment to be found in Scripture, I couldn't find it. The fact is we're winging it here. We're winging it because science has gotten way ahead of us. We can do brilliant things as a civilization. We welcome a great deal of it because it extends life, it eases pain, gives us a greater feeling of depth about our existence. Yes, it doesn't answer everything, and there are moral questions, and I'm just here to state as one person that I don't think you're going to find all the answers to that or even a very significant basis for thinking about it in old or new Scripture. Now, if you have it next time, because you keep telling me how wonderful religion is, why don't you bring it into the discussion? Tell us where in Scripture we can deal with this cloning issue in a more significant way.
We'll have to come back to that. We're also not going to have a rant because time is short because of the heated debate today. Just 10 seconds, Tony. Bob Novak stormed off after cursing live on CNN with James Carville. Has he lost it? What's the talk at the bar?
Having talked with Carville on the air and others, I understand how he briefly lost his restraint. He's a wonderful journalist, 48 years in the business. CNN ought to invite him back awfully quickly.
That's all the profanity we have time for today on Left, Right, and Center. Thanks, as always, to Bob Scheer, Tony Blankley. Sarah Spitz produced. She deduced today's program. Our technical director is Ray Guarna. I'm Matt Miller. Thanks for listening. Tune in again next week for another hot edition of Left, Right, and Center.
Oh, so if you like pajamas,
pajamas,
I'll wear pajamas.
You got pajamas.
Well, we
know we need each other, so we better call the calling of all.
Audio archives and podcasts of KCRW programs are at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about Left, Right, and Center, email lrc@kcrw.com. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by 89.9 KCRW Santa Monica and kcrw.com.